WTOP goes in depth on the issues that affect you. It's Ask the Governor with Virginia Governor Bob McDonald. Live from the Glass Enclosed Nerve Center, your hosts Mark Seagraves and Mark Lewis.
To be a part of the program this morning, call us toll-free at 877-336-1035. That's 877-336-1035. You can email questions at WTOP.com. You can also send in questions via Twitter using the hashtag AskTheGov. Now, here's WTOP's Mark Seagraves.
Governor, welcome. We appreciate you coming in every month, and there's always a lot to talk about with you. Let's start off with traffic, because that, I think, a lot of people, particularly our listeners in their cars, are concerned with traffic. And in fact, today you're going to announce some good news for commuters in our area. So why don't we start right there?
Absolutely. You're always asking me to make news, Mark. Today I can comply.
I appreciate that.
We'll be announcing a little later today that we have brought to financial close the project to create and expand the HOV and hot lanes on I-95. It's a big, big project. It's a $1 billion project, $919 million to be exact. It's 29 miles all the way from Garrisonville. I think it's around 610 all the way up to the mixing bowl to Edsel Road. And that's one of the most congested spots that we've got, particularly around Fort Belvoir, Newington. That's my old home and stopping ground. So we're announcing today this partnership. It's about $1 billion. They will start literally next week on the construction. The project will be done at the end of 2014. So that'll be 29 miles of road now with an additional lane on either side that people can use. We got great bonds, bond rates, about 2.4%. And so it's really driven the cost of the project down. So this is a big step forward for that 95 corridor.
So everybody sees the hot lane construction that is underway very close to the Maryland line.
Right, on 495 now.
On 495 now. And so this will be much like that, the same plan.
That's a great point. Yeah, the hot lanes that are currently underway, which will be done very soon, are from the mixing bowl all the way out to Tyson's, and that's gone pretty well on budget, on schedule. Same vendor, Floor and Transurban, two companies together. But to have that hot lanes network to the mixing bowl and then not have the rest of it south doesn't make sense. So this is a project we've been working on for a while, and the deal has just been signed by the Department of Transportation, and we'll announce the terms of that today and a lot of information. We get a $300 million loan from the federal government, TIFIA loan. Very low interest rates. So it is, I think, a well-financed, well-capitalized project, and is going to do a lot for congestion relief in that corridor.
Breaks ground next week, you say. When can people expect to start driving down those hot lanes?
Well, late 2014. It's about a 2.5-year project. It's estimated there'll be 8,000 jobs, Mark, during the course of the construction, about a $2 billion total economic development impact on the region. But they're going to start right away. I think they've literally, the final documents are signed August 7th, I think, and then the project's starting August 8th. So it's going to be starting right away. They've shown an ability, this same vendor, to be on time and on budget with the other hot lanes on the Beltway. So we're optimistic that they'll have the same performance.
And so here, you say public-private partnership. How does this work once the lanes are open then, as far as who sets the rates, who collects the money, where the money goes?
That'll all be done by the Department of Transportation, whatever the toll rates. People, HOV3, free. It's only you pay a premium, a congestion pricing, if you have less than three people in your car and you choose to operate those lanes. There'll also be more park and ride facilities. I think there's eight more points of access and egress to get on and off of 95. So it's more than just the road itself. It's more infrastructure along the way. And everybody who drives that way in the morning knows that we need improvements there, and this is a step forward.
Virginia Governor Bob McDonald, we're going to talk about sequestration, surplus, health care, all your questions for the governor after a look at what's going on the roads right now.
You're listening to Ask the Governor with Virginia Governor Bob McDonald on WTOP. Now back to your hosts, Mark Seagraves and Mark Lewis.
Your chance to speak to the governor is right now at 877-336-1035. That's 877-336-1035. Email a question at WTOP.com. You can join the discussion on our Facebook page or send in a question using Twitter, the tweet with the hashtag AskTheGov. Here's Mark Seagraves.
Governor, every now and then we learn a new word, and the word of the day or the week is sequestration.
Yes.
And this is the self-imposed deadline that Congress put on itself to come to some resolution about budget cuts and tax breaks. Or else mandatory budget cuts will go into effect.
Right.
And that deadline is looming. In 5 months from now. You have a message for Capitol Hill about how this is going to impact people in Virginia. And really, the impact is regional. It's a big impact, if this happens, on D.C., Maryland, and Virginia.
Well, the message is simple. Don't do it. Get your act together. Mr. President, lead. And let's fix this. This was never meant to really be a policy. It was meant to be a hammer. It was meant to create a sense of urgency and pressure for the Congress to actually get a rational approach to budget cuts. Listen, we're broke in the country. We are $16 trillion in debt. This president's added $1 trillion in new deficit spending every year. So everybody agrees we have to cut. And I think every area of the budget, including defense spending, has got to be part of it. But what they did is they said, look, to get that debt deal last year to keep us from going under, they said that the super committee will meet, and if they can't reach an agreement, then there'll be $600 billion in defense cuts, $600 billion in domestic spending, and of course, you know the rest of the story. Super committee failed. Congress hasn't acted. President won't lead, and here we are, 5 months to go, and defense industry in D.C., Maryland, Virginia, and around the region are saying, look, we're getting ready to have to send layoff notices under the WARN Act to people in 2 months.
Now, the Labor Department has said that that's
not
necessary.
That's nonsense. I think that's a political document, in all candor, based on what I read yesterday. And
you believe the Labor Department is giving the president cover?
Well, you have to find out why they did it. It's not a very well-reasoned opinion. And frankly, it's really going to be up to the defense contractors on whether they need to act, because it's not really up to the Labor Department. Individual workers could file a legal action. It's going to be up to a court to determine it. And several defense contractors have already gotten adverse judgments in court over the last decade or so for not doing it. So I think they're going to err on the side of caution. It's nice to have Labor Department guidance here with 2 months to go. But the bottom line is they still need to act, Mark, because $600 billion of cuts in defense on top of the $487 billion that have already taken place, I think are going to have an impact on our national security, but certainly on the defense bases in Virginia and the hundreds of thousands of defense industry workers around the Capital Region. It just needs to be done in a logical and orderly way. Nobody expected $600 billion to actually go into effect. But since they haven't acted for a year, it's now looming in just a couple of months.
You focus on defense, and a lot of the conversation has been focused on the defense portion. That seems to be where the stalemate is, whether or not to address just the defense or to address the entire budget as a whole. What would your guidance be?
Well, I think they need to address everything. I mean, to be honest, the $1.2 trillion in cuts isn't a drop in the bucket. We add more to the national debt every year. President's averaged $1.2 to $1.5 trillion of new deficit spending every year, $16 trillion in debt, growing to $25 trillion by the year 2021 under his proposed budget that's been shot down in the Congress. We're in some deep financial trouble in America. So, yes, I think every area needs to be done. But there was not an organized plan. The Defense Department has issued no plan on how that $600 billion is going to be allocated. And so we just need to, knowing we're still in a dangerous world with a war in Afghanistan and a drawdown in Iraq and other challenges, is how do we do it? There's not a strategic vision on how to get there, not to mention Virginia is second only to California in the number of jobs that would be lost, 122,500, according to the George Mason study. Maryland also at the top of that list as well. So we're concerned about the economic impact as well as the impact on the readiness and security of the United States. Let's have a reasonable way to do it. But I tell you, Mark, there's got to be dramatic cuts across the spectrum. It's what we did in Virginia. It's why now we have another surplus, third year in a row, because we're making the tough choices. We're setting priorities. We're cutting. We're reforming government. We balance our budget on time, like 49 other states. It's time the federal government get that done.
And we're going to talk about your budget in a little bit, but let's get a caller in here, and let's go to Ed, who is calling from Arlington. Ed, you're on with the governor.
Hello, Governor. A couple months ago, you signed the repeal of one handgun a month, despite public opinion polls unanimously showing that Virginia citizens didn't want you to sign the bill. Quinnipiac University poll, Christopher Newport, Richmond Times, 71% in the final poll were asking you not to repeal this very popular law. How can you justify not doing what the people told you to do?
Well, it's probably not a surprise to you to say if you solely govern by polls, you're not going to be a very effective leader. And that goes not just for gun issues, but on a variety of things. First of all, I would say that we've had the policy in place for about 20 years. I originally supported it because we had significant violent crime related to drugs and guns for drug trade between New England and Virginia. And I thought at that time that there was things that needed to be done. But since then, we've had any number of other new laws with the instant background check system we put in place in Virginia. We've had new bills dealing with the straw man purchases and other criminal penalties. We've seen crime go down. The General Assembly passed the bill with a pretty wide margin, at least in the House of Delegates. And so the representatives of the people duly passed the bill. And so I think it vindicates the Second Amendment rights of people, whether they buy one gun a month or two guns a month. The issue is what they do with a gun after they purchase it and whether they chose to defend themselves or engage in sporting activities or whether people make bad choices about creating crimes. I mean, that really is the heart of the issue, is the individual responsibility of the gun owner or the car owner or anything, any other instrument that could be used for ill purposes. So I appreciate the question. I understand it. But I thought the policy really was no longer needed. There are other laws that help to protect our citizens, and the legislature passed it.
Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell taking your calls, your questions via email, Facebook, and Twitter on Ask the Governor.
From the Glass Enclosed Nerve Center, it's more of Ask the Governor with Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. Now back to your host, Mark C. Graves and Mark Lewis.
Governor McDonnell taking your phone calls at 877-336-1035. That's 877-336-1035. Email us at WTOP.com. Send a tweet. Use the hashtag Ask the Governor. You can ask the Gov. And you can also send questions on WTOP's Facebook page. Here's Mark C. Graves.
Governor, you touched on it when we were talking about sequestration, and that is for the third year in a row, you have announced a surplus in the state of Virginia of $130 million. I think, while that's great news, I think people want to know, where is that money going to go, and where are they going to see that money, particularly as far as it comes to transportation in Northern Virginia?
Well, first, that's only part of the surplus. That's just the revenue surplus. We're still closing the books on savings. So the surplus is going to grow. The last 2 years, we've had $945 million. This will be hopefully another couple hundred million. By statute and by constitution, Mark, it's designated to go to certain places. The first claim is in the Rainy Day Fund. So we're going to dedicate about $90 million to the Rainy Day Fund, bringing our total to nearly $700 million. We're very excited about the cash
reserves.
And that,
in layman's terms, is the state's savings account.
It is, yeah, for literally the rainy days. And we've used a lot of that the last couple of years because of the downturn in the economy. When I took over a couple of years ago, it was down to about $290 million. Now we've got it back up to about $700 million. And then there are other obligations in the statute to the Water Quality Improvement Fund and other things like that to clean up the environment. But a portion of that this year, at my request, is going to go to a bonus for our state employees who haven't gotten a raise in 5 years. It worked very effectively to motivate performance in 2010. We did it again this year, a 3% performance bonus. So if we have the proper savings that I expect over the next couple of weeks, then we'll have a 3% bonus for our state employees. But the good news is the growth, Mark, has been in income tax and sales tax. It means Virginians are making more money, and they're spending a little bit more money, meaning they have consumer confidence. Unemployment's down to 5.7%, the lowest in the Southeast. So our economy in Virginia is recovering a little bit better than most states, and it's a result of our focus the last couple of years, I think, on policies that expand economic opportunity and targeted tax cuts and foreign trade trips and all the things that we've done on a bipartisan basis to grow the economy. And now we see it in the surplus revenues and the revenue growth of 5.5% this year.
You note how Virginia leads most states in the country in this area. How about regionally? Compare it to Maryland. Why do you think Maryland...
You trying to make me take that bait, Mark?
Why do you think Maryland has a problem in this area that you don't seem to have a problem? I mean, you share a border, you're right across the river. What goes on differently in Virginia than in Maryland?
Well, as I've said many times, Martin O'Malley and I work together well on a number of things in the region, whether it's crime or environmental cleanup, transportation. We do things together. But we also have some different views and different policies when it comes to taxation. Maryland's had a couple of years now of tax increases. This year was no exception, trying to push tax increases on gas and income and cigars and water and a number of other things. We've taken a different approach. We don't raise taxes. We've had targeted tax cuts in certain economic areas. We create a very strong work environment in terms of taxation and regulation. We keep regulations low. We have a good litigation climate. We're a right-to-work state. Maryland's not. That's a huge advantage. Like Maryland, both of our states have good universities and colleges. We've just had some great reforms to really increase access to be able to have great workforce development in the future. And so, yeah, we've had some competitions with Maryland when it comes to jobs, and been fortunate that a lot of employers have chosen Virginia. Several businesses have chosen recently to come from Maryland to Virginia, and there was a story about a number of residents because of the tax burdens in Maryland have come to Virginia. So, listen, I think this is the way Mr. Jefferson intended it, that the states are the laboratories of democracy and innovation. Different governors can do different things and choose different policies, and people can choose with their pocketbooks and on where to go. And I think Democrats and Republicans working together in Virginia have created a great place for people to live and work.
Let me switch gears and ask you about a letter that the many states got from the ACLU is asking for information about license plate reading technology. This is advanced technology that many, if not most, states use to track cars coming and going, and then on police cars in Virginia, state police vehicles have these license plate reading technology. And the ACLU, like many people, want to know how that information is being used and how long it's being held for. What is being done in the state of Virginia on the state level as far as license plate reading technology?
I don't know exactly the state police protocols. Obviously, using technology to assist law enforcement is something that law enforcement agencies around the country continue to do. We always try to balance the legal and constitutional issues to make sure that they are used consistent with people's individual freedoms and liberties. That's vitally important. On this particular technology and the substance of the ACLU complaint, Mark, I have not seen the letter, so I really can't comment.
How long do you think the state should hold on to that information? I mean, you've been a law enforcement official. Mm-hmm. How long do you think legitimately the state can hold on to that information?
Well, again, there may already be policies set in the statute. I'm just telling you, I'm not particularly familiar with those. It just seems to me whatever is common sense for law enforcement purposes. I mean, they use those imagine scanning to see, just like they do right now. Prior to that technology, they occasionally do license plate checks to determine whether or not there's anything going on, or whether they have somebody speeding at a distance to know what kind of whether there's a CAPEUS outstanding or something like that before they make the traffic stop. There's all those common sense issues, but I don't know what the protocols are at this point. We may already have policies and statutes that cover that. I'm just not familiar with that.
Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell here until 11 o'clock, taking your calls via phone, email, Facebook, and Twitter. Now look at traffic and weather on the 8th.
It's Ask the Governor with Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, live from the Glass Enclosed Nerve Center. Your host, Mark C. Graves and Mark Lewis.
To join the discussion, call us now at 877-336-1035. Please be patient. Our phone line's jammed, 877-336-1035. Email a question at WTOP.com. You can send us a tweet. Use the hashtag AskTheGov. Here's Mark C. Graves.
Governor, recently Darrell Issa, Congressman Issa, has opened up the possibility of at least discussing a commuter tax in the district, allowing the district government to impose a commuter tax on those who live primarily in Virginia and Maryland who travel each day into the district to work. Right now, the federal government prohibits D.C. from doing that. What are your thoughts about your constituents paying into the district coffers?
This would be considered a softball question, I take it, Mark. I don't think my constituents would be particularly crazy about that idea. Listen, I think D.C., and you know I wrote some letters early, I think they ought to have some more budget autonomy. I'd feel really bad if Virginia were hamstrung by major federal government limitations on how we could run the government. So I think there's probably some room for flexibility there, and Congressman Issa, I think, is open to that. But from what I've heard about these commuter tax proposals, I think, speaking for Virginia citizens, we would not support that.
But you say you would be upset if Virginia were hamstrung. Washington, D.C. is hamstrung by federal regulation. Just about any other state in the country can charge a commuter tax, and many do. Does Virginia charge a commuter tax?
No, not to my knowledge.
So why are you not upset that D.C. is hamstrung by this federal regulation?
Well, I don't see what the basis would be for taxing Virginia citizens merely for the privilege of driving into the district. I mean, we don't tax people from coming from West Virginia or Florida or D.C. into Virginia merely for the privilege of driving in Virginia unless we have a toll. So I'm not sure what the logic would be. Listen, I know governments at every level are strapped right now and looking for new revenue sources, and there's limits in the tax base. But I tell you, the approach we've taken in Virginia is we want to grow through economic growth and economic development and job creation programs and growing the economy, not by raising taxes and finding new ways to get more money out of the people. To me, that's the right approach, and I think the jurisdictions that have done that, in fact, a lot of them that have Republican governors, you see their unemployment rates going down and their tax revenues going up. So that's the advice that I'd give folks if they're looking for revenues, is put together some conservative fiscal policies and support entrepreneurs and support businesses, and you'll grow.
While we're talking about the District of Columbia, you'd have to be living under a rock not to know that there are federal investigations that have resulted in two D.C. officials resigning, facing prison terms. Harry Thomas is already in prison. And Mayor Gray is continuing to be investigated by the feds, and three of his campaign aides have pled guilty. And the U.S. attorney has said that the Gray campaign deceived the voters in D.C. You have to work with Mayor Gray. You know him well. What do you make of these allegations and the investigation surrounding the District of Columbia?
Yeah, Mark, I just can't comment on any of those, especially in light of the fact that there may be ongoing investigations. I'm going to let law enforcement handle all those. Whoever are the duly elected representatives of Maryland and D.C., I will work my best with those administrations to do what's good for the Capital Region.
Since the last time you were here, the Supreme Court ruled on the federal health care mandate. And at issue in Virginia, amongst other things, is how you'll handle the Medicaid expansion. You seem to be wanting to join several other states in not expanding Medicaid. There are those who say that Virginia will lose out on a lot of money, particularly hospitals will lose out on a lot of money. Mm-hmm. What do you say? How do you explain your decision about Medicaid expansion?
Well, we haven't made final decisions yet, but there's some significant concerns, and that every governor around the country has to deal with. The fact that the court decision, number one, surprised us by ruling that it was lawful under the Tax and Spend Clause as opposed to the Commerce Clause, which they said you could not use that interstate commerce power to impose an individual unfunded mandate on a taxpayer. But secondly, that they struck down the portion of the bill that said that the federal government could withhold Medicaid payments from states. That gives us now the ability to determine whether or not we want to expand Medicaid. Here's the problem. And I agree with what President Obama said in 2008 and 2009. And that's essentially Medicaid is a broken system. And if you expand it and put more money into a broken system, it's not the right thing to do. He was right then. But yet that's what he's asking us to do now, is to make that expansion. I say if you expand Medicaid without fixing it and reforming it and giving flexibility to the states, it's irresponsible. Mark, Medicaid is breaking the budget of every state in the country. We've gone from 5% to 20% of our budget over the last 30 years, 1,600% growth in Medicaid. That's before Obamacare. And now we've got this new mandate on Virginia for or expansion opportunity. And I want to make sure I'm not deceiving the citizens of Virginia by saying, look, the federal government's promised to pay 100% in the first 3 years and then 90%. Federal government doesn't have the ability to pay its own bills now. We're borrowing $3.6 billion a day. We're not going to buy a pig in a poke. So without significant reform, and I'd say consider block grants, consider taking the shackles off of Virginians to allow us to find creative ways to manage our health care system and our Medicaid system, it would not be responsible to expand Medicaid. So we've got a lot of things to work through. I wrote a letter to the federal government 2 weeks ago on behalf of 29 Republican governors, 30 legitimate questions, and I got a non-answer letter back. If that's the way they're going to approach it, we're not going to get very far. So I'm hoping we'll get serious answers about a serious issue.
Any idea when you'll make a final decision?
Well, I'm certainly not going to make it before the election.
Are you just hoping that the Republicans get in?
Not
and
hoping.
Overturn it?
Well, yes, I am absolutely hoping that Mitt Romney is the president of the United States. But more than that, I think it's irresponsible to start with all these state-based exchanges and expanding Medicaid when Mitt Romney said, if I'm elected on day one, I will give states a waiver from the most onerous requirements of Obamacare. And number two, I will propose legislation to repeal and replace Obamacare and come up with a market-based series of reforms that is cost-effective. So why would I waste taxpayer money for the next 100 days when the situation may change dramatically in 100 days?
Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell taking your questions on Ask the Governor.
You're listening to Ask the Governor with Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell on WTOP. Now back to your hosts, Mark Seagraves and Mark Lewis.
To join the discussion, our phone number, 877-336-1035. That's 877-336-1035. Send us a tweet, use the hashtag AskTheGov, or join the conversation on WTOP's Facebook page. Here's Mark Seagraves.
Governor, a couple of people called in asking for an update on the car tax in Virginia. What is the status of the car tax?
Well, as you know, Governor Gilmore led the way to phase that out back in 1998, and it was phased out to about 70%. And then in 2004, legislature capped the total amount of money going to car tax phase out, which is basically state money going to localities to offset their loss of revenue because the car tax is a local revenue source. And it was capped at $950 million, the total state to local government transfer. So that's where it is now, which means it's about, I think, 67% phased out. And that's where that's been now for 8 years. I think many of us would like to see the rest of that phase out take place. But obviously, with the fiscal challenges that we've got at the state, that would take another $500 million to $1 billion, I think, to do that. And I just think there's not been any movement on that here in the last 8 years.
Let me throw you another softball here. One of the big questions in Virginia of late has been beer or wine. What is your answer to that question?
Well, it's both. You know, we have great craft brewers that we've signed some new legislation this year to make it easier for these entrepreneurs to grow. In fact, this is Craft Brewery Month. I just signed a proclamation. And, of course, our wine industry is now the fifth largest in the nation behind the Pacific Coast states in New York. Made tremendous strides over the last couple of years in quality. Just won 24 medals out at the San Francisco Wine Festival. One of the top three wine destinations in the world. One of the top 10 in the world. One of the only three in America, according to Wine Enthusiast magazine. And, you know, our largest industry, Mark, even though we're a high-tech, manufacturing-oriented, aerospace-oriented state, agriculture is still our top industry. So it is about a $750 million economic impact, the wine industry, every year. But it's more than that. And I think you told me you're one of the contributors to Virginia wine tourism. You come down there and you see the vineyards. They're all in historic areas. People spend money traveling in our state, see the history, and have a great glass of Virginia wine. The industry goes back to the settlers in 1619, where they all had to plant 10 vines, and then Mr. Jefferson brought vines back from France. So the last 30 years, though, has really seen the industry come into its own. So the honest answer, it's both. It's a great part of Virginia's agriculture.
Let me ask you, I know you come up here for one reason, one reason only, and that is to answer my monthly question.
That's right, and for the last month.
And this, I guess, is the last time I get to ask you this question. Beth Myers, who is heading up Governor Romney's search for a vice presidential.
Does she know anything about this, do you think?
Well, you tell me, because here's what Beth Myers told a group in Virginia. We have a deep bench, including your governor, an incredibly able guy, Myers said, referring to Virginia governor. All sorts of really great people, and I'm sure that whoever Governor Romney decides to pick will be a great addition to the ticket. She was talking about how deep the Republican bench is, and she put your name right there on that bench. So now your name has been mentioned by the Romney search people. What say you, Governor?
What I say is she was playing to the home crowd. You did mention she was speaking in Virginia.
I know, I think I did.
She to Virginia
here, right.
Women.
Yes.
So anyway, it was nice of Ms. Meyer to say that.
Are you being vetted? Have you provided any documents, any kind of tax records?
I'll tell you next month.
Okay, well, we'll as soon all know as next month.
Well, that's when I'll tell you.
Will you tell us next month if you were vetted?
I'll tell you some things next month. Right now, I'm excited about my role as the chairman of the platform committee. As a surrogate around the country for Mitt Romney and helping him win Virginia. I just believe that our country's in enough problems economically and fiscally that we have got to get the greatest country on earth back to working out of debt. And I think Mitt Romney is the only guy with the plans and the vision to do it. So that's what I'm doing.
You know, he's been in Europe and he's been criticized for what a few people have been calling gaffes that he made. One, questioning whether Great Britain was ready for the Olympics. And then second, a comment he made about the economy in Israel versus Palestine. What do you say as a supporter of Governor Romney to critics who say that this was a misstep for the governor when it came to foreign policy?
Well, of course, if you're an opponent of Governor Romney, you're always going to look for the negatives. People, I think, maybe largely ignored the rest of his remarks, which were, I thought, excellent. One, he's going to strengthen and build relationships with three of the great countries that are allies with America: Israel, Poland, and the United Kingdom. Where Prime Minister Cameron, I got to meet with the Prime Minister David Cameron myself just 3 weeks ago when I was there. He's doing a great job making tough decisions to try to get England out of debt. So I think these discussions are helpful. Listen, I think Mitt Romney obviously knows a little about the Olympics. He ran one of the greatest Olympics probably we've ever had in Salt Lake City in 2002. So maybe he's a little more critical than the average fan. But he was very complimentary overall, but he did raise some security concerns. In Israel, the breadth of that speech was outstanding. Unfortunately, this president's been equivocal in his support for our greatest ally in the Mideast. A small country of 8 million people that is a warrior for democracy and democratic values, more entrepreneurs, I think, per capita than any country in the world. They know how to start up businesses. And so he was going to celebrate some of the great achievements of Israel and making the distinction between a country that has economic and political freedom, like Israel, and some of its neighbors that don't and have more bureaucracy and less freedom. And so that was the gist of his remarks. And I think he'll have good meetings in the great Catholic country of Poland and come home refreshed.
More with the governor after a look at traffic and weather.
From the Glass and Close Nerve Center, it's more of Ask the Governor with Virginia Governor Bob McDonald. Now back to your host, Mark Seagraves and Mark Lewis.
Final moments of the program till 11 o'clock. Your chance to get in to speak with the governor now at 877-336-1035. That's 877-336-1035. Here's Mark Seagraves.
Governor, let me ask you about a couple of topics that have been national headlines lately, and that is first the Chick-fil-A controversy. The head of Chick-fil-A has come out in support of same-sex marriage, in opposition to same-sex marriage. And a lot of people, including some local leaders, including the mayor of Washington, D.C., have come out and said, you know, they don't want that kind of business in their jurisdictions. Others have gone out and made a point of going and eating at Chick-fil-A in support. Do you want to weigh in on this?
I love chicken. No, I think if we start having governments issue permits or issue zoning changes or withholding those because of someone's business, political or religious beliefs, we are going down a very, very bad road. So I've been disturbed, and whether it's an issue on the right or the left, I think people have an ability to start a business and grow a business regardless of their political beliefs or religious beliefs. So I think making this connection is a very troubling thing for us.
Let me ask you, you make no secret of you're a fan of sports and college football particularly.
Even the Maryland Terps, when I was a kid.
The fabulous Maryland Terrapins. What about the NCAA sanctions on Penn State? What do you make of those? Did they go far enough, not far enough? How do you see those sanctions?
Well, I thought they were significant, when not only the dollars, but the bowl appearances. But ultimately, you know, the sad part, Mark, is it harms the kids.
Kids?
The future kids that are coming to play at Penn State.
What about the kids who were raped?
Oh, no, I understand that fully. And that's why I think the sanctions were tough and severe and swift. And in light of what happened with Sandusky and the rest, and no question that the NCAA needed to act and act with resolve, and they did. My point is the kids that are coming in now, let's say the new recruit this year that had nothing to do with it. He just wants to go to Penn State, get a good education, play a little football or basketball or hockey or whatever the case may be. And now, obviously, this program is going to be imperiled for a long time. So it's certainly sad, but I think we clearly have to state that irresponsible and criminal behavior can't be tolerated. And when administrative folks and coaches are aware of it, they've got to act quickly to protect young people. And if they don't, there's going to be severe and swift sanctions. And I think this was the right approach. And there's going to be there'll be more lawsuits and probably more things going on. And I think that serves a clarion call now to sports people around the country that they got to police their programs. And the good news, Mark, I think overall from what I see is most of our universities, your alma mater included, run very, very clean programs. And when something's amiss, coaches act decisively. They suspend players. They let people go, and they act in the fine traditions of our country.
Let me ask you about something that you and I have been talking about for months, and these are your appointments to the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority.
Yes.
You have three appointments that are still in limbo.
Yes.
One of them is in a lawsuit, is suing over his dismissal, and then two are held up because of a lack of action by the D.C. Council.
Yes.
What's going on with this?
Well, it's exasperating. You know, I have Virginia taxpayers pay the overwhelming amount of money to fund this Rail to Dulles project that now Loudoun County has approved. But we are a minority shareholder when it comes to the board appointments. Maryland and D.C. and the federal government dominate those appointments. President Obama signed a new law last November to give Virginia two more slots and Maryland and D.C. one more slot. And I still can't get D.C. to pass that. And we continue to get fighting from the MWA board that, as you know, has had a not a good report from the U.S. DOT IG that has said that there was some spending problems and management problems. So I think that there's room for dramatic improvement in MWA. They need a seat, our board members. And we have tried for 6-7 months now to try to get this done. The General Assembly approved a law this year, overwhelmingly, to seat Virginia board members. And I'm trying to cooperate. We pledged $150 million to the projects. But it seems like on a regular basis that the current leaders of MWA, many of them not from Virginia, continue to ignore the interests of Virginia taxpayers and ratepayers and tollpayers and not giving us the representation we're due. So it's very disappointing. And I'm going to do everything possible through legal means and political means to have the law honored.
At what point do you just say enough is enough and you do something drastic like withhold funding?
Well, Mark, I have tried to be a cooperative with them, and we've made progress on several fronts along the way. They've got a new executive director. I've got two board members seated, Tom Davis and Todd Stottlemyre, who are excellent leaders up here. So we have some representation on there. But in due course, I think this will work out, whether it's going to take legal action or we have a couple of those lawsuits right now. But there's no question. I've been unequivocal with everybody from Secretary LaHood to Mayor Gray to the leaders at MWA that they've got to follow the law. Virginia, as the overwhelming contributor financially to these projects, our rights have got to be vindicated. And why they continue to ignore the law and not seat our members is just beyond me. It's a complete lack of cooperation, and ultimately, I believe Virginia's citizens will prevail.
Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, we appreciate you coming in.
Okay, Mark.
Thank you.
Always great to be with you.